Welcome to this time's Future of Leadership podcast. And today I have a very special guest, a person who I personally really admire. He is an American psychologist, and he was Darwin Cartwright Professor of Social Theory and Social Action at Swarthmore College, and now is a visiting professor at Haas School of Business at Berkeley University. And I got to know him when I saw a TED Talk years ago, which is called The Paradox of Choice, which was really stunning for me and obviously for many other people, because it was clicked millions of times. And then we had the pleasure to welcome him also at our Future of Leadership conference about what truly progress means. And he's also writing a lot of essays, for example, in the New York Times, and books in which he criticizes our society, and from a social behavioral viewpoint is looking what are the patterns that you can observe there. And therefore, I think today it's very interesting to talk with him about the lessons learned from COVID-19 crisis. So welcome, Barry Schwartz. Hi, Barry. So,
hello, Sebastian. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So you are sitting somewhere in the Bay Area. The sun is shining. You told me that you already did some exercise this morning. What else, or what has changed in your daily life since the COVID-19 pandemic has started?
Well, so I am among the very privileged few. First of all, I'm mostly retired. I continue to work, but what it means to work is that I sit at my desk in front of my computer and I write and I talk to people. And that's sort of what I've been doing now. It's a beautiful environment. The weather is gorgeous. So my wife and I take long walks every day, and we don't have to worry about what we're going to do if it rains or it snows, because it doesn't. It's just always nice. We have not been inside any building aside from our home since the second week in March. So we've done all our shopping by delivery or by driving to parking lots and having people put stuff in the car. And we like to shop. We live in a neighborhood where there are lots of small shops. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a rich person's problem. It's not exactly a hardship. The main hardship is that one of our kids and with two of our grandkids live 2 miles from us. And because the kids' parents are not working from home entirely, they won't let us into their circle. They're worried about making us sick. They work in a medical facility in San Francisco. They're not frontline workers. I wouldn't say it's super high risk what they do, but certainly when you're out in the world, there's some risk, and they just don't think that old people like us should be exposed to it. So we've been doing a lot of Zooming with our grandkids and some walking in parks, keeping our distance. And, you know, I really want to hug them.
That's
a real hardship.
Yeah.
In the grand scheme of things, it's a pretty minor hardship compared to what other people are going through.
But still, it's an observation I also did myself, that I think human beings are social animals. At least I'm a very strong social animal, so I like to hug people. And then you really observe that there's a certain lack of hugging. Fortunately, I'm living here with my 3 kids and my wife, so I have something to hug. And now we will even... a dog will join us soon in 2 weeks, so I have enough things I can pet.
Things to hug. Huh? No, there's no question about it. And aside from the health effects, which are obviously very salient, and the economic effects, which are devastating, there is this kind of social emotional effect of trying to be sensible that it's hard to quantify. But I think is really, really devastating and may linger after we go back to living some version of normal life.
So you mean that that could something that kind of changes human behavior, that this kind of social distancing really becomes a little bit more part of how people behave, and that they will suffer from that, or how do you see that?
Well, I think people would suffer from it if it persisted. Mm-hmm. What I'm imagining, and it's very hard to know. I've been asked by several people to make predictions about the mm-hmm. world, what the world's going to look like after this is over. And I don't think, I think it's foolish to try to make predictions. Nobody knows what the world's going to look like. But the critical thing is, which of these adaptations will persist and which of them will gradually fade out mm-hmm. as we go back to the life we used to live. And I don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. My guess is that we will stop shaking one another's hands.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be permanent. My guess, although this is sort of iffy, is that there will be a lot more people wearing masks in public a lot more often.
Mm-hmm.
But with respect to other things, it's really hard to know. You know, mm-hmm. I don't think, you know, we're opening up here in the United States, quote, opening up. Nobody wants to go to restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't mean nobody, but people are really reluctant. They're asking themselves, is it worth the risk? I don't know how big the risk is, but how important is it to eat in a restaurant? And it's going to take some time for people to get over that. It may take a long time. And it wouldn't surprise me if some of this did become permanent.
And I mean, this is really something that we just discussed before we started the podcast, that I think also people right now, I mean, there's some things that they become cautious about right now. So they became aware of risks. And actually, I think especially such a pandemic risk is really something that it's hard for us as humans to understand because of the kind of exponential development and so on. So there's kind of diffuse fear that situations could be dangerous on the one side. On the other side, I really think that during the last 3 months, people learned a lot by themselves. As we said, for example, they learned that you can work from home office. I personally learned that it's a big relief not to travel all the time. And I even learned cooking because I had no opportunity to go to restaurants. And now I really started like cooking. So actually, I think for a person like you who has been observing social action your entire life, a situation like this must be very interesting, at least, because there's so many different things of social dynamics and going on that can be researched. So what have been the most interesting social dynamics for you, and what are things that you really said, this could be an interesting development also for the future?
Well, so with regard to work, and we were talking about this before the official conversation began, people who are lucky enough to do the kind of work that you and I do are now working from home. Everybody hates commuting. Research has shown that of all of the activities of daily life, it ranks at the absolute bottom. It's what people most dislike about their lives is commuting. Employers, managers, don't trust that people who work at home will put in a fair day's work. They think somehow that you need to be looking over people's shoulders, otherwise they're just going to malinger and goof off and play video games and watch porn on their computers and who knows what. Well, they may do some of that, but they're still going to be more productive working from home than they typically are in the office. I don't know what your life is like, but I would find, as an academic, that I got more work done in 2 hours at home than I did in a full day in the office. There were a million interruptions. And so I developed a pattern where when I was writing or preparing a lecture or something, I didn't come in. I stayed home. And when I came in, basically the office door was open and it was an invitation to anybody who wanted to talk to me to come and talk to me. So we vastly underestimate the amount of time we waste in the office. And so I think a lot of more enlightened companies are going to learn that you get just as much productivity, maybe more, and more energy out of employees if you let them work from home. And so when the health reasons for isolation go away, we may well not return to the kind of work that we were used to. Facebook has announced, for example, that working from home is now going to be permanent, not until the pandemic ends, not until a vaccine is produced, but forever, for maybe half or more of its workforce. Who knows how pervasive this will be? My guess is that half the people who do office type work could do exactly the same things without going to the office, and probably do them with more energy and productivity because they're not killing themselves commuting. And the benefit—it's
an observation that we did as well. So the feedback from managers we got is that at least everything that is about knowledge sharing and information sharing is much more focused if you do it remote than if you have 150 people in one room and you have a lot of noise and they have to travel there and they have this social dynamics that you have in a room and you have to chat with everybody. So you get rid of all that so you can really focus. And I agree with what you said. I myself, you know, now traveling much less than before. I enjoyed it. And I did some interactive labs virtually. So I did the start the moderation. And then when they were in breakouts, I was able to make the garden of half an hour. And so then I came back and went on. And I could use all this dead time that in a hotel I would just have been, you know, wasted by waiting for something, by other things. So that's really interesting.
And the other thing that we have to appreciate is we haven't had a lot of practice doing things this way, right? We've been doing things face-to-face and in person for 10,000 years. We've been doing it this way for 3 months. So who is to say how much better we'll get at this kind of remote digital, both solo work and also, you know, collaborative work as we learn the tricks of the trade and as the applications that enable us to do this get better, get more and more sophisticated. So basically from a dead start, we have produced an amazing amount of collaborative, interactive stuff in a very short time. And I think the possibilities are limitless. There is a problem. A lot of our socializing comes from the interactions we have at work, where, I mean, we work half our waking lives. And so if that gets taken away, is that going to leave a big hole in people sort of emotionally? And I suspect the answer to that is yes. It may produce strains in intimate relationships, family relationships, because you're together all the time. And a lot of marriages thrive because the partners have relatively independent lives, and you're going to be a lot less independent when you're both working from home.
So it's a stress test for family or for
It is a stress test. So people are going to have to learn how to do that too. This is a new thing, you know, probably forever. The guy would go and work in the fields and the woman would work in the home. So even if there wasn't commuting to work, they were still physically separated for large parts of the day. That may become a thing of the past for many of us, and we're going to have to learn how to cope. And my guess is that there's going to be an enormous influence of sort of social and cultural norms. My guess is that some societies will adjust to this much more rapidly and much more adaptively than others. Because I don't think we do anything as individuals. We do everything we do in the context of the culture that surrounds us. And cultures are really different. And we may observe cultural differences that were not obvious to us as a result of this new challenge that we're facing. You know, most people would think there's not much difference between the United States and Europe. And within Europe, there's not much difference between one country and another, maybe the North versus the South. You know, there's a kind of homogeneity. Well, that may turn out not to be true. And we'll see these countries peeling apart in the way, not only in the way in which they respond to the actual pandemic, but the way in, but what they do after the pandemic, what they look like after the pandemic is over.
Do you have an hypothesis which kind of cultures are in advance and which might have more problems adapting to this new environment?
Well, I mean, there is a distinction that psychologists make between individualistic and collectivistic cultures. Mm-hmm. That's a very broad brush distinction. Most of Western industrial society is highly individualistic. And you look to East Asia and South Asia for developed countries that are more collectivistic. Mm-hmm. So that by itself might lead, I would think that the sort of mechanical adjustments to living this way are easier in an individualistic culture mm-hmm. than in a collectivist one, since we're mostly operating as free agents anyway. Mm-hmm. With regard to the social and emotional, it may well be that the collectivist societies have the upper hand because bonds to family and community are so strong that they can survive this kind of separation in a way that, you know, individualistic societies have a harder time doing. But this is just a guess. Mm-hmm. As I said, anyone who makes predictions about the future is almost certainly a fool.
Now, I really think it was very interesting observing how the mankind as a whole now reacted to this coronavirus. At the start of the year, for me, it was very far away. And then actually I was very personally overwhelmed how quick it came into our arena and how quick yeah. politics reacted. And I just had a call or a podcast talk with Rüdiger Fox, who is philosopher and CEO of a company. And he said he saw the positive aspect that mankind showed that we are collectively able to accept a certain crisis and to react to it. So there was kind of an insight in many societies that people had to change behavior and they were willing to change behavior even though it was not enforced legally or by police. So for example, in Germany, it was really that most people behaved in a different way even before it got there was this kind of official regulations. So do you see that as a chance or do you see it more as a threat? Or how would you, from your scientific standpoint, how did you observe how people reacted to this kind of new, I mean, actually, it's not such a new threat. It's an old threat, but it became very vital yep. within a very short time.
So, you know, it is interesting. I haven't seen sort of a detailed, granular account of how different societies, say in Europe, have responded to this. But in the United States, there, you know, everything about the United States is polarized. Mm-hmm. Now, you wouldn't think that there would be polarization about a virus, mm-hmm. but there is. Mm-hmm. And you have people marching up and down, celebrating their freedom and autonomy and wanting the state to get off their backs. And you have people who are appalled at this attitude and want everyone to be asking, not just what do I want, but what serves the community. Mm-hmm. And there's a real tension between these. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear that that's going to go away. In fact, arguably, this has taken a polarized society and intensified the polarization. And mm-hmm. if the danger recedes, you know, and the spikes that everyone is worrying about don't happen, I think this will get even, this separation will get stronger and stronger. The sense I get is that in other societies, perhaps Germany, certainly in Denmark, I gather in Sweden, I think in Australia, New Zealand, this was a non-issue.
Mm-hmm.
We're all in the same lifeboat.
Actually, in Germany, it was really that at the beginning, the people were very disciplined. So they were very insightful and they reacted very cautious. Now, for sure, many of them were reacting because the argument was it's to save the health system so that there will not be a strong wave of people that have to go to the clinic and that the clinics will not be overwhelmed. Now, after 2 months, people start getting nervous and there is for sure now a little polarization about the ones that want to keep the things very cautiously. I think it's still 70%, but there is a minority that says, hey, we want to have back our civilian rights and we want to be able to move and meet wherever we want. But at the beginning, there was a really big consensus. So was that different in the US?
Well, very much so. Well, it's interesting because if you poll citizens, 70% of the American population prefers caution to opening up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They want this process of sort of slowly edging back toward the way things were to be very gradual, very cautious, mm-hmm. very data driven.
Mm-hmm.
70%. So that sounds not so different from Germany. Mm-hmm. What we have not had here is political leadership that tells that sings that same song.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've given a kind of energy to the minority, to the 30%, that maybe doesn't exist in Germany and in the rest of Europe. I mean, it's hard to overestimate the impact that President Trump's comments have. And as far as he's concerned, it is throw open the doors, come out with guns blazing, and produce an economic uptick that's exactly as steep as the collapse was so that I can get reelected in November. So he's really for throwing mm-hmm. caution to the winds, and that has a big impact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people who are kind of thinking that but won't say it out loud are emboldened to say it out loud because their national leader is saying it out loud. And I don't see any of that in most national leaders in Europe. I mean, I think Boris Johnson maybe a little bit in the early going, but he certainly got humbled.
Yeah, he got really humbled by a strong experience, yeah.
Yes, but, you know, and Merkel, bless her heart, has been, you know, she's a scientist.
Yeah.
And she sort of responded to this in the way you'd want a grown-up to respond to this.
I mean, actually, it was very interesting that at the beginning of the crisis, the politicians in Germany were very, they stepped really back and let the scientists take the comments. So it was really, at the beginning, you didn't hear anything from the politicians, but first you heard from Mr. Drosten. So he's like, I think you're Mr. Forky or how he's called. And people listened to them and then they started to comment after a certain while, but they really gave a big attention to what the scientists said.
And it seems to me that's as it should be.
Yeah,
exactly as it should be.
And actually, I mean, sometimes we were watching the statements of the White House as well, and I had the feeling that the scientists didn't feel invited to say what their real opinion was because of Donald Trump, who is having his own interpretation all the time. So is it a problem that this kind of president, by his behavior, which is very rigid in his statements, and that he gets so much public attention that he somehow puts the attention away from what people really should talk about, or how is your...
There are many facets to this. I think there's a lot of speculation about the lead science advisors in the US. You know, like, how can they tolerate it? You know, he says X and they know X is false. And they don't say outright X is false. And they don't say, and they don't resign. And the question is why? Mm. And a lot of people's speculation is that Fauci, for example, has decided that the best he can possibly do is stay inside the circle, inside the room where it happens, and try to prevent the very worst things from happening, even if it means sort of sanding smooth the differences between what Trump says and what Fauci knows to be true. Mm-hmm. You know, and there are people who indignantly say he should resign. How can he stand for this? Mm-hmm. And then you think, well, if people like that resign, who's going to be whispering in the presidency?
Yeah.
So I think they're in a really, really difficult position. Yeah. But what I think that in the long term, the thing that most troubles me is the contempt for truth. Mm-hmm. You know, science is not the only way to get to the truth, but it sort of is our shining example of what truth can be, what truth finding looks like. And sometimes the truth is not what you want it to be. And there's a kind of willingness to reinvent reality so that it is the world you wish it was rather than the world it actually is. That gets an enormous amount of encouragement from our political leaders. And Trump, of course, is the worst offender here. He's just completely indifferent to what's true.
At least I read that he was saying you should drink
Clorox. Drink bleach.
Horrocks, and then the number of cases where people got poisoned by Horrocks immediately jumped.
And there were lots and lots of calls to local public health agencies asking whether they could actually take a small glass of Clorox. I mean, and the company put out all of these advisories. Don't, whatever you do, it says right on the bottle, do not put this inside your body. So you know, this will stop. This will get past this. But what I'm not sure of is what will remain in terms of our respect for expertise, authority, evidence, and truth. I'm not sure. Now, this has been under assault for a much longer time than the last 6 months. It's kind of now italicized and in boldface because the stakes are so high. And my guess is that this sort of skepticism about expertise is going to take a long time to undo. That's what I find. So, my politics and Merkel's politics are probably very different. I'm pretty sure she's much more conservative politically than I am from what I've read. She is just such a beacon worthy of respect because she admires people who know things and she listens to them. And, you know, you would just assume that any leader would do that. But no, it turns out. And I think we have an Uber Trump now in Brazil.
Yeah. But I'm interested in because for us, for sure, our picture of the United States is very much created by the messages about Trump and so on.
Yeah.
Is the sentiment in a state like California very different from other states?
Oh.
So would you say, is there kind of a common feeling right now all over the states?
There is not a common feeling. It's, just as our country is polarized, it's reflected state by state. California, where I live, is the model of respect for expertise and evidence. California, Northern California shut things down before any other place in the United States. And the result, although the population density is high, is that we have not come close to overwhelming our health care institutions, and we've had relatively low rates of infection and death. Partly it's good luck, and partly it's the foresight of our leaders. The state of Washington, similar. There are other parts of the country that never closed down. Some states never closed down. They would urge people to socially distance. They would urge people think about wearing masks, but they never shut down. They eliminated like large scale events, concerts, sporting events, and they may have closed bars, but that's about it. So there's a vast, vast array of different attitudes now. And in truth, if you live in a part of the country where the population is not dense, the COVID problem is not so different from your every year flu problem.
For sure.
Some people are going to get very sick. A few people are going to die. But it isn't the sort of thing where you turn life inside out. If you live in parts of the country where population density is high, like in New York and, you know, on the coasts, well, then it's a whole different story because of exponential growth. People, I teach decision making. I have for many years. And it is very hard for people to understand what exponential growth looks like. You know, early in the process, there's not a big difference between 1, 2, 3 and 1, 2, 4, right? It's barely noticeable, the difference between ordinary arithmetic growth, 1, 2, 3, and exponential growth, 1, 2, 4. You go out another 10 steps, and the difference is massive. And people can't get their heads around it. There's been research done suggesting that if New York had shut down, if the country had shut down 1 week earlier than it did, we would have saved 35,000 lives. If we had shut down 2 weeks earlier than we did, if we had shut down when South Korea shut down, we would have saved 70,000 lives. Now, it's hard to imagine how can 1 week make such a big difference unless you understand what exponential growth looks like.
I mean, isn't this a big challenge for us as humanity in these times? And could Corona perhaps help us a little bit at least understand the danger of such kind of non-linear developments? Because I mean, there is other risks that we are exposed to as well, like climate change and so on, where you also have this very slow developments that might then somehow have kind of an exponential drive. And isn't it a general problem of humans that we are not able to really feel long-term risks, but that we are only able to feel risks and react when we immediately feel kind of in danger ourselves? How do you see that?
So you said a couple of different things, and I think they're both true. Yes, we tend to be remarkably insensitive to risks that are far in the future and very sensitive to risks that are immediate. You know, I mean, people smoke because heart disease and lung cancer are 30 years away. Why should I worry about that now? So yes, there is a short term and a long term. But the other problem, the non-linear dynamics of things, you know, this I don't know how this problem can get fixed except if sort of educated people act on behalf of the citizenry. I don't know that we can educate people so that they appreciate what non-linear processes look like. Think of this expression. I don't know if you have it in Germany. The miracle of compounding. You know, you start putting money away in your retirement when you're 25 as opposed to 45, and you have, you know, 10 times as much money when you retire.
It's the sale pitch of any financial advisor, isn't it? Huh?
Yes, but why is it a miracle? Why is it a miracle? It's only a miracle because people don't understand non-linear processes. And we can't get them to understand that, even though they have that experience in their everyday life. So you basically have to tell them, listen, I'm not going to explain why you should be putting money in your retirement account starting when you're 25. Just do it. Trust me. you'll be happy. Mm-hmm. Because it just seems no one has figured out how to make intuitions about nonlinear processes natural for people.
This would also mean that what you just said, that you have the feeling that scientists, you know, have a strong stand right now in the political arena, at least. But in the end, we would need more power to the scientists to solve the complex problems of our times.
So within my field of decision-making research, there's this idea that has gotten a lot of attention that instead of letting people do whatever they want and sometimes make calamitous mistakes, or forcing people to do what you know is in their best interest, find ways to nudge people, mm-hmm. to make it easy for people to do the right thing, harder for them to do the wrong thing, but not require it. So in the case of retirement, most companies in the U.S., participation in the retirement plan requires you to opt in.
Mm-hmm.
Sign a form that gives your employer permission mm-hmm. to withhold some of your salary and put it into some investment vehicle. Mm-hmm. How about if you switched it so that that was the default? You were in the retirement plan and you had to opt out.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, you are free to choose. In the first case, you're free to choose yes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do nothing, no money's put away. In the second case, you're free to choose no. And mm-hmm. if you do nothing, money is put away. Mm-hmm. So freedom of choice is equal. However, you make it really easy for people to participate in mm-hmm. retirement, because if they do nothing, that's what happens mm-hmm. in the opt-out case. And when you do that, you triple the rate of participation in mm-hmm. retirement plans. Mm-hmm. And so you're not being indifferent to mm-hmm. people's welfare, nor are you, and letting them make whatever mistakes mm-hmm. they make. Nor are you compelling people to do what's in their best interest. This is middle ground. And there's a lot of research that's been done by people in my field about where the levers are that you can pry to make it easier for people to do things that serve them well and a little harder for them to do things that don't serve them well without compelling. So I think, and we see Britain has the government, quote, government nudge unit. I don't know if mm-hmm. it still exists under Johnson. It did under his predecessor. And that's what they do. You know, we want people to participate in retirement. How can we nudge them? How can we push them in that mm-hmm. direction? We want mm-hmm. people to go for annual checkups. How can we push them, nudge them in that direction without requiring it, and so on? So I think that what you would like is scientifically informed tools mm-hmm. that really make it as easy as possible for people to do what is in their best interest, and mm-hmm. hard but not impossible for them to do things that don't serve their interests. Mm-hmm. That way we cater to freedom, but we also acknowledge our imperfections as human beings and try to overcome them by making the right choices easy to make.
And yeah, that's what you say.
That may be the future, but notice, Obama instituted something similar in the U.S. to the British nudge unit. Obama had profound respect for science, for expertise, mm-hmm. as I think most presidents have had in the U.S. And that's why that happened. What Trump has done essentially is to undo every source of expert guidance in pretty much every government federal government institution. How long will it take to rebuild this collection of experts when there's a new president? And I don't know how that works in Germany and in other countries.
Yeah, but I think what you say is very interesting, and I think it's also a big challenge for us if we want to solve the problems as they are, that we accept this imperfection of human awareness and behavior that you just stated, and that we do not understand freedom as that we can do whatever we want, but that we accept a politics that helps us to somehow nudge or have behavioral incentives to overcome these imperfections. Yeah, we had a very good example discussing about the smoking, that you're forbidden to smoke in a restaurant. 15 years ago, when this in Germany, this law was introduced, people really were angry and said, why we want to smoke in a restaurant, and this is a reduction of our personal freedom, that we have no choice to do it or not. Now, if you would ask the people, do you want to have back the ability to smoke in a restaurant, I think 95% would say no. But it's very, it's something that might polarize a society, this kind of discussion. Is freedom that you can do whatever you want, or can there be some decision makers that, supported by scientists, understand where we as humans are imperfect in our decision making and help us to overcome that?
But it isn't only that. It isn't only that we're imperfect and the government might help us to overcome some of our shortcomings. The other dimension is, and smoking is the example here, is that we underestimate the extent to which the things we do affect other people. Mm-hmm. And so I could say, listen, if I smoke, I'm only hurting myself. I know what I'm doing. You have no right to tell me what to do. Maybe I'm being foolish. I have a right to be foolish. And what the movement that led to the banning of smoking in public places was spurred by evidence that that's simply not true. When I smoke, I affect you. Mm-hmm. I affect anybody in the vicinity. There are all of these health effects for bystanders. And that sort of gave permission to states to prohibit the activity, because it wasn't just a matter of your rights. It was a matter of how your exercising of those rights had an impact on other people, innocent bystanders. You know, there's a saying in the United States that your right to swing your arms around ends at my chin. You know, you can swing your arms around as much as you like, but if one of them hits me in the chin, you are in trouble. Mm-hmm. Well, smoking, you can think of that. You can smoke as much as you want in a closet or on a deserted island, but not in places where other people are. You just can't, because you affect other people. Now, my own view is that almost everything we do has effects on other people. So it isn't enough to say, well, if it affects other people, the state gets to tell you what to do, because that would be way too restrictive. But there are some of the effects of our behavior on other people that are massive and very consequential. And then it seems to me states should be able to tell people what to do. And you're right, though. The extraordinary thing is how quickly people went from being rabidly opposed to smoking bans to being enthusiastic supporters, even people who smoke. It happened in less than a generation. Mm-hmm. And that social norms don't usually change that fast. Mm-hmm. So that's a kind of encouraging example that people can learn to appreciate what the public authorities are telling them to do or urging them to do.
So coming to an end of our discussion, for us, we also want to talk a little bit about a vision of a world after Corona, because I think we are living in a time where a lot of assumptions about what is going well and not are kind of questioned, and there's a high degree of uncertainty. So what, in your eyes, should be the key learnings from the current situation, from the current collective experience that we have? And how would a positive vision of a society in the future look for you? So what are kind of wishes or hopes that you have, where you say, if we could learn that, then, especially also from a decision-maker perspective, perhaps, then we would have the chance to use this current experience for the longer good?
Well, I have two thoughts. First, I don't know if this is going on in Germany, but we are going nuts celebrating the heroes of the pandemic. which is not just providers of healthcare services, mm-hmm. nurses, doctors, and so on, but people who stock grocery shelves and deliver things to groceries, all of the people who actually have to go to work, who can't do what you and I are doing. We are celebrating them as heroes, people who work in nursing homes. Now, I think it's great that we're celebrating them, but they were heroes 4 months ago too. Mm-hmm. And not only did we not celebrate them, we completely ignored them. We treat them like dirt. We don't pay them enough. Mm-hmm. They don't have benefits. If they don't show up for work, they don't get paid at all. You know, they're invisible to us. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden, because of the growth of our need, we treat them as heroes. So what I would love to see linger is a kind of deep respect and admiration for the people without whom we would have no life to live at all, who we have systematically mistreated, certainly in my society, and I suspect also in yours.
Absolutely. They are the worst paid from all the jobs that you can imagine. Huh? Mm-hmm.
Worst paid. And what do we entrust them to? In the United States, childcare workers and nursing home staff get paid miserably, and they're taking care of our children and our parents. We're entrusting them with the welfare of the most valuable things in our lives, and we're paying them minimum wage. What sense does that make? So I would love for this to linger after their heroism is less dramatic. I'm not optimistic that it will, but if we keep it in our minds, we can maybe urge public institutions to show the kind of respect and admiration to these people that they deserve going forward. That's one. Second, to me, the deep lesson of the pandemic is that efficiency is a two-edged sword. Societies have so focused on efficiency in production, because what economists tell us is that the only way to actually increase standards of living mm-hmm. is by increasing efficiency. You know, we have to be able to make the same stuff for less money in order for our own real standard of living to go up. Efficient, just-in-time production, no wasted inventory, easy financial transactions. So, in a microsecond, you can sell these stocks and buy these stocks. More and more efficiency. And any asset that is not being deployed productively is a sign that your system is in need of improvement. Mm-hmm. I think there can be too much efficiency. Mm-hmm. I think we need redundancy. Mm-hmm. I think we need to create a system that not only can function when everything is going well, but can also function when everything starts to fall apart. And that means devoting resources, devoting assets to things where they will not earn their keep unless mm-hmm. something happens. Mm-hmm. You know, stockpiling medical equipment is wasting millions and millions of dollars mm-hmm. until there's a pandemic. Mm-hmm. And this enormous pressure on organizations not to waste a dime. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, I think there'll be a lot of attention paid to supply chains and stockpiling, all very much focused on the particular shortcomings of this pandemic. I'm less sure that people will focus on more generally mm-hmm. the downside of being super efficient. Mm-hmm. And I would like more slack in all of our economic and social mm-hmm. systems, so that when the inevitable, catastrophic, unpredictable event happens, we'll be able to cope with it. So those are my two lessons. Respect people
that's very interesting.
After the pandemic mm-hmm. and dial down your worship of efficiency.
And I mean, this really would be something also for corporate or organizational leaders to rethink their controlling, to rethink the way they do business plans, which are very much focused on efficiency. Because in the end, I mean, I have seen a lot of business plans in my life. I never have seen one business plan that really happened to be realized in a way that he was done years before, because reality always is somehow different from what you think at a certain point of time it may be. So is to make society and organizations future-proof and more resilient against crisis. And I think one lesson that we might have right now is that also crises are, perhaps they will not be the new normal, but they are always there. So always there is a certain risk that a crisis that like this will come, and that you then really have to think, how can we, even in such a worst case scenario, survive by keeping redundancies. I think that's a very interesting.
I think that's right. Instead of being maximally efficient, what we want to be is efficient enough. The pressure in the private sector to produce results on a quarterly basis so that your shareholders are happy and you get a bonus all pushes in the direction of streamlining, making maximal use of every asset, and being maximally efficient. And if you are less efficient, you may lose your job, or you may, your share price may go down. Those are the worst possible incentive structure if what we want, what we're trying to do, is create an economic system that is resilient to unanticipated future calamitous events. We don't know which of them will happen and what stress they will produce on our system. The one thing we can be absolutely certain of is something will happen that puts an enormous strain on our system. And pretending that that's not true is really completely, is socially irresponsible. So those are the two lessons I would like to see people take away.
Barry, thank you very much. So what will the rest of your day now look like?
I think I'm going to take a nap, because when you start your day at 4 a.m., as I did, naps seem incredibly attractive. It's going to be quite hot today. I take a walk every day, but today I may pass on it because it's going to be in the high 80s and strong sun.
Okay.
Yeah, which is unusual. In my area, it's usually in the low 70s, mid 70s. So I haven't quite figured out what I'm going to do.
So I wish you a very good day and a good time. And I very much hope that you will quite soon you be able to embrace your grandchildren again in person and not only via Zoom meeting. So thank you very much.
And I'm glad that you are able to embrace your kids and your soon your dog.
Yeah, I'm very grateful for that. Okay, wonderful. See you.
Bye-bye. Yeah? Take care.